It's Lake Effect from Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Mitch Tyke. Thank you so much for tuning in today. The eyes of the world remain on Boston in the wake of Monday's bombings at the finish line of the Boston Marathon. The attacks, which killed three, were described by President Obama as an act of terror. While the incident was not as deadly as the 9/11 attacks, it was a reminder that in a global context, terrorism is a sad and frequent fact of life around the world. It's one confronted by police forces and government agencies, but also by the United Nations. It happened that Canada's ambassador to the UN was in Milwaukee this week. Guillermo Reshinsky stopped by the Lake Effect studio to talk about terrorism and other issues the UN is confronting. Ambassador Gil Reshinsky, welcome to Lake Effect.
Great to be here.
As we're having this conversation, the bombings in Boston are fresh in everyone's minds. Leaving out the specifics of that incident, let me ask you this. How do you evaluate the UN role in reducing the threat of global terrorism or its active role in counterterrorism?
Well, I think there is a recognition at the United Nations that terrorism is not a unique phenomenon. It exists around the world. It's something that we have to have a collective approach on, but obviously the nature of the phenomenon makes it necessary that national approaches really be the frontline kind of response when these incidents occur. In 2006, the United Nations, on a unanimous basis, passed a counterterrorism strategy. That document remains as relevant today as 7 years ago, and it really did try to create sort of the elemental foundations of approaches to combat terrorism and the factors that we needed to take on board, everything from economic to cultural. And it still serves a very, very useful purpose. And the UN reviews that strategy every 2 years. And last year, Canada had the good fortune and the honor to chair the review of the strategy. And we were able to introduce new language in the strategy on issues associated with victims of terrorism. We were able to introduce language on the need for internet-based use by terror networks as something that that national governments needed to focus on. And the amount of training and the amount of capacity building that is now being done by the Counterterrorism Executive Directorate reporting to the Security Council and the Counterterrorism Integrated Task Force, which is part of the UN Secretariat, is really something to behold, with regional centers set up in places like Kuala Lumpur, like Algeria, like in Chile, to be able to bring to bear the collective expertise of counterterrorism experts from around the world and transfer that expertise to countries that have identified needs. So I think there is a recognition that we're all in this together. While it is a local phenomenon at times, these networks are hugely sophisticated. The use of financing and international financing mechanisms is obviously of great concern. But collective approaches, which is the raison d'etre of why the UN exists, is very much at the fore in terms of how this is being combated worldwide.
Of course, the United Nations was founded in the wake of World War II. Wars were really between countries. This was about about conflicts between specific nations. Is there something particularly challenging for a body like the United Nations when it comes to terrorism, which is by its nature not a country versus country? It's a splinter group within a country versus sometimes a splinter group within another country.
Absolutely, and I think the quintessential challenge to the United Nations is how does it reorganize itself to be able to deal with the changing times that we're in. I mean, you're absolutely right. The UN came into being after the carnage of World War II, where state conflict had been at the core of that set of problems, if you will. And now here we are 68 years later with the reality of non-state actors now being the center point, if you will, of violent action in many parts of the world. And the UN is still structured by and large in the 20th century and now has to adjust and adapt like any organization to the phenomenon that it's encountering around the world. And this is having an impact, for example, now in how peacekeeping is organized. If you follow the Eastern Congo, for example, the creation of an intervention brigade now as part of the last mandate renewal of the UN mission in Congo, MONUSCO, takes the UN to a very, very different place from the point of view of more robust peacekeeping and, in fact, as some would argue, perhaps into the realm of peace enforcement. This is a response to the times and the nature of the problems that need to be addressed. And a large organization like the UN inevitably is in catch-up mode far too often. And this is part of the challenge of what we're facing both in New York and the other elements of the UN dispersed around the world.
Well, and that's an excellent point because we often hear about the United Nations in kind of a reactive way, that the UN is sending peacekeepers to a world hotspot, but this is an existing hotspot, or that it is passing a resolution in reaction to something that's occurred. Is there a proactive story about the United Nations that you think is perhaps not being told?
Oh, very much. And I think, 80% of what the UN does isn't seen. And that's really focused on the aspects of the UN's work in improving the daily lives of people. Why do people turn to violence? In many instances, they turn to violence because of lack of hope, because of lack of economic opportunity, lack of resources, and the UN, through its development elements, tries to improve living standards, improve health standards around the world as a means of mitigating potential sources of conflict. The other element that the UN uses to great effect are special political missions, where when they see an emerging situation, when you know that there is internal tension in country X or country Y, the placement of a special envoy or a special representative to the Secretary General into that country as a mediator, as a facilitator, as a means of keeping the conflict capped, if you will, before it emerges, is a big part of what the UN does and an enormous element of the expenditure that the UN puts into the field every single day.
We talked about terrorism, but I want to turn to a specific situation outside North America. What do you think the UN role in the ongoing situation involving North Korea ought to be at this stage?
I think the UN's role is probably quite appropriate given the fact that the Security Council continues to ratchet up the pressure with respect to sanctions against the North Korean regime and the provocations that we've seen of late. I think on North Korea, the world is speaking with one voice. The question we all ask is, are they getting it? And important regional players, be it South Korea on the one hand or China or Japan, obviously have a lot at stake given that this is their neighborhood. But it's something that that I find salutary in the sense that the Council has been able to come forward with a series of declarations and specific actions to demonstrate to the North Koreans the nature of the unacceptability of the kind of course that they are moving on, and hopefully this will result in them going back to a place where we can manage this situation with a bit more tranquility.
How do you see that situation? I mean, are Kim Jong Un's high-profile statements and threats really about the rest of the world, or do you think they are more about his own leadership, say, in relation to the North Korean military, or can you even separate the two?
That's very hard to say, I think, and there's a lot of far more educated speculation than my own in that respect. But no matter what it is a point of destabilization. And when you have points of destabilization that threaten to go off the edge of the cliff, if you will, the UN has a responsibility to act. And I think both the Secretary General and the Security Council have stepped up to the plate to try to do that. What motivates Kim Jong-un? Your guess is as good as mine. Those who have ostensible influence on him need to be able to exert that influence. They need to engage him very forthrightly so that he understands the consequentiality of actions. But when you put water to a boil, and you don't have a lid on it, I mean, the water can go over the side. And this is the great fear that that everyone has, because we're talking about a state that is well known to possess some level of nuclear capability. So it is a great concern. And I think it also points to the importance of ongoing efforts on the issues of proliferation, because the proliferation of nuclear technology results in states perhaps that are less stable having that those kinds of capabilities, which is deleterious to the well-being of the planet as a whole.
As you say, the rest of the world is essentially speaking as one when it comes to North Korea. Let's shift to Syria, which is a much thornier issue, and talk about the tightrope that the UN has to tread in a case like Syria, which has parts of the world really divided.
It is, and it's regrettable that at times the world can't come together around an issue because of various either multilateral or national interests that are at play. The tragedy of Syria, of course, is that 70,000 victims have already perished, and the likelihood of more is something that should sober us all. Is there an endpoint going forward in Syria? You've got to hope so. The discussions continue in terms of the range of options, both within the Security Council and within the General Assembly. The regional players certainly have an important role to play. We may not be in a position to solve the political nature of that dilemma right now, but we know that there is a humanitarian tragedy that has emerged as a result, with something in the order of 1.2 or 1.3 million refugees. And there the UN is stepping up through its coordinator for humanitarian assistance, the UN High Commission for Refugees, to try to attend to that problem. And then on a humanitarian basis, try to ensure that those who remain in Syria, trapped behind one line or another, have the ability to access at least basics of life from the point of view of food and some level of health while they're at it. But it is it's an intractable problem given the geopolitical nature of this conflict. Mr. Brahimi, who is the special representative of both the UN and the Arab League, remains engaged. There is a hope, certainly I have it, that at some point his presence becomes useful from the point of view of brokering a solution. Clearly, we're not there yet. But over the course of the passage of time, I hope that we can move in a scenario where there is a cessation of violence as a minimal to be able to attend to the affected civilian population, and that that provides the space to look at some level of political discussion. Because my biggest fear, and this is a personal view, is that notwithstanding the high levels of violence that we've seen to date, if one side prevails over another over time, we could be looking at levels of violence after that are even greater. And there, I think there is a responsibility for the world to come together to ensure that that doesn't happen.
You have been outspoken recently on the slow progress in Haiti. What is your assessment for where that country stands today and what the world community should demand of the leaders there?
You know, Haiti has been a place where my own country has been involved since the 1960s through development assistance. Haiti's singular challenge is, on the one hand, poor governance, and on the other hand, lack of opportunity for a population that lives at a level of standard of life far inferior to the rest of this hemisphere. The fact that the UN saw fit to stand up a stabilization mission. It's not a peacekeeping mission per se in terms of a conflict situation, but it is there to try to stabilize in the absence of a viable national security sector. I think in Haiti we are seeing some progress now from the point of view of a better security capability on the part of the Haitian National Police. But the issues of governance and Haitians themselves coming together around a vision for their own country going forward beyond the fractures and fissures which have so characterized that society for the last 50, 60 years, is where the rub comes. And the UN being on the ground, being a catalyst, if you will, to hold the government to account in terms of the things it needs to do, to ensuring that the social welfare systems are in place to attend to the needs of the population, whether it's in education or in health, these are important inputs, if you will, to ensuring that the situation gets no worse. And hopefully you see improvement over time. But this is a situation in Haiti, like so many around the world, that is that is in the hands of the local population itself. We look to the UN to solve the world's problems. And the UN can help. But at the end of the day, people in their own community, in their own country, have to have the wherewithal to come together and address the problems themselves, because you can't impose solutions from the outside. And so Haiti is an example where a key role is played, but it is a very unique and not necessarily repeatable kind of role from one context to the next. But given the recent history of the country and with the earthquake and the levels of devastation and injury, the UN, I think, has a appropriately stepped up and raised its game, trying to find a means to assist the Haitian people move forward to a better place than where they've been.
Canada is typically a strong ally of the United States, yet its place on the world stage is much different than the U.S. How important is the work of the United Nations to Canada and Canadians, do you think?
Oh, I think it's very important. I mean, you know, we want to see a U.N. that's effective. We want a U.N. that's accountable. I think there we share the view of the United States that as major contributors to the organization, we expect transparency. We expect value for money. We're not afraid to criticize the organization when needed. But we're both, I think, countries that come to the United Nations from the perspective of working collectively to try to improve the specific issues that the U.N. is dealing with. For Canada, it's a little bit different. Clearly, we are a middle power, if you will. Historically, we have worked with allies, like-minded is, I think, the term that's used. But in recent years, we have taken the position that on certain issues, we will have hard and fast positions. We will not go along to get along, simply to be non-controversial. And that has had costs from time to time. But I think the level of engagement and, more importantly, the level of financial commitment. I mean, the United States is the number one provider of resources to the UN. Canada is number seven. So we are two top 10 contributors that the organization looks to from the point of view of its own financing, and more importantly, for the kinds of people to populate UN entities, the Secretariat itself, missions on the ground, who bring commitment, who bring a culture of accountability to those challenges, and are there to do the very best that they can. I mean, I wish I could tell you and your listeners that everyone around the UN is there to see how they can make the organization better. That, unfortunately, at times is not the case. But in the case of Canada and the UN and the U.S., I think we can say that we try to contribute jointly to improving the organization in any way we can.
Gil Rushinsky, thank you so much.
Thank you, Mitch. Great pleasure.
Guillermo Rushinsky is the Canadian ambassador and permanent representative to the United Nations. In the past, he served as Canada's ambassador to Colombia and to Mexico and served as a diplomat in Chicago as well. He was in Milwaukee yesterday to speak to the Rotary Club and at Marquette University. We'll take a break now, and in just a moment, a Wisconsin baseball player tries to solve an age-old issue: that it hurts to catch a baseball. This is Lake Effect from WUWM.